Hi everybody, welcome along to Wednesday night. Gosh, it's
It's
Wednesday, Kim.
Wednesday.
Wednesday night, and those of you online are welcome to our class. So we begin as we normally do. So this requires that you all are comfortable in your seat, that your sort of back is straight, shoulders relaxed, you got your feet on a cushion or flat on the floor, and you can put your hands wherever you like. So once you are comfortable, just relax and let your body breathe itself. And feeling the body breathe itself, just relax into the awareness of that. And while the body is relaxed and breathing itself, imagine that the nature of the ground beneath your feet is made of a starry sapphire light. It's very soft to the touch. And the space above you is filled with rainbows and offerings. But in the space directly in front of you, at the level of your eyebrows, imagine a lion throne appearing. A throne held up by four pairs of white snow lions. And on the seat of that throne is a lotus, and on the lotus are sun and moon disks lying flat. And on the moon cushion is sitting Buddha Shakyamuni. And he is surrounded by an assembly of enlightened beings, which include other Buddhas, bodhisattvas, deities, and protectors, and so forth. Meanwhile, on the ground where you are all sentient beings. They surround you. On your left hand is your mother, on the right is your father. Behind you are your family and closest friends. And in front of you are people who've had misunderstandings with and difficulties. And what we want to do is to lead all of these people in the safe direction of these enlightened beings, their teachings, and their community. Now, at present, we have the leisure and opportunity to do this, to lead others in a safe direction. And this is only because we're still alive. So while we are alive, we need to act quickly. As you know, death is certain and it can take place at any time. Now, things are not quite right because the impermanent things appear to be permanent. The things that are not pure appear to be pure. Phenomena without self appear to have self. The things are not quite right, and the world does not exist as it seems to. So, while this is the case, nevertheless, we have met a spiritual friend who is leading us in the safe direction of the three rare sublime ones: the Buddha, our teacher; the Dharma, his teachings; and the community, which accompany us in our seeking freedom from suffering. So to make this offering of practice as purely as possible, and here the practice is to lead all beings in this safe direction. I want you to imagine yourself to be as clear as a deity. This means that your body has no physicality whatsoever. It just is appearing as light. And this light body of yours, in its hands, are holding a vajra and bell. And you're sitting within a sphere of great enjoyment. And it's from within the sphere of great enjoyment that you recite the refuge pledge and generate the mind of enlightenment. So please join me in saying, I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha to benefit all sentient beings. In response to this heartfelt wish of ours, from the heart of each enlightened being above us, lights and nectar stream down. And these dissolve into ourselves and all living beings. And our negative karmas and obstructions are purified. And our health and lifespan, virtues and realizations are increased. So having been cleansed with wisdom and fortified with compassionate love, recollect the four immeasurable thoughts. And then decide to develop these yourself and to establish all beings into those four immeasurable states. To affirm this, join me in saying, may all sentient beings have happiness and its causes. May all sentient beings be free from suffering and its causes. May all sentient beings never be separated from the happiness that is without suffering. May all sentient beings abide in equanimity, free from the bias of attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. In response to this wish of ours, from the heart of each enlightened being, lights and nectar stream down. And again, these dissolve into yourself and all living beings. And negative karmas and obstructions are purified. They're washed away. And our health and lifespan, virtues and realizations are increased. So from this empowered position, breathe in and exhale and let yourself just relax. And from this relaxed state of awareness, invite the field of virtue and ready merit, which now appear. And we say in front of them, reverently I prostrate my body, speech, and mind. I present clouds of every type of offering and action of emerging. I declare all my negative actions, accumulated sins, beginning this time, and rejoice in the merit of all holy and ordinary beings. Please remain until the end of cyclic existence and turn the wheel of Dharma for living beings. I dedicate my own and others' merits to the great enlightenment. So I've accumulated some merit, and we've purified the body, speech, and mind somewhat. So we don't want to sort of cling to this virtue we've created. So to prevent that, imagine that your body, speech, mind, your enjoyments, in fact, the world itself sort of becomes filled with light and then reappear as a wonderful, pure land, which we can use as the teaching base for all sentient beings in the future. And we're going to offer this pure land to the Buddha and his entourage. And so we say, this ground, anointed with perfumes, strewn with flowers, adorned with Mount Meru, four continents, the sun and the moon. I imagine this as a Buddha field of offering. May all living beings enjoy this pure land. The offering has been made, and the Buddha accepts it with delight. He gazes down at us and smiles, and we look up into his eyes. And looking into the eyes of the Buddha, We recollect renunciation. We wish to definitely emerge from all suffering states and their causes. We recollect the mind of enlightenment, that we're doing this not just for ourselves, but for the benefit of all beings who we've recognized as our very own mothers. We also recollect the correct view that all these phenomena are empty of any intrinsic nature and dependently exist, dependent upon mere imputation. Recollecting these three principal aspects of the path, we aspire to become fully awakened. So, induced by our wishes and prayers, there emerges from the Guru Shakyamuni Buddha a second figure who absorbs into us, whereby our form clearly becomes that of the Guru Buddha. Radiating from a syllable at the heart, life rays strike all sentient beings surrounding you, placing each of them in the state of a Guru Buddha. So you and all beings are now seen to be fully awakened beings. At the heart of each of you, there is a moon disc upon which is a white syllable, and it's encircled by the mantra of the Buddha. And you begin to recite it. Chayata Mahamaya Soha. I think that all these beings surrounding, all these enlightened beings, they are dissolved into light and are drawn back into your heart. And you think the two purposes are achieved. I've achieved my own enlightenment, and I've helped everybody else to awaken too. However, this has all been on the level of imagination. Being on the level of imagination has imprinted our consciousness. So through that virtue, may each of us quickly achieve the state of a Guru Buddha and be able to actually place all sentient beings without exception in that very same state. You think this is the purpose of study, of reflection, and of meditating, and this is what you wish to do. Now breathing in through your nostrils, exhale through your mouth, let your eyes flutter open, and move your body until you feel quite comfortable once again in your seat. So we begin as we normally do by just looking at what we've covered already. So of course this is our third week, so we've covered 2 weeks. So meditation, this word meditation in Tibetan is gom, and it means to familiarize or to cultivate virtuous qualities. So to meditate is to subject the mind to a mental gym. It is mental training to reduce harmful states of mind and to cultivate beneficial ones. And the purpose is to transform the mind. And this transformation takes place using two forms of meditation: stabilizing meditation and analytical meditation. And you have a reason for doing this. This is what you need to have for yourself. Of course, you have reasons for being here. In terms of those reasons, though, you can look at them from the point of view of three scopes. Let's say a person who begins, person of small capacity, just wants to avoid the sufferings that will take place after this life. In particular, the sufferings of rebirth in the lower realm. don't want to come back as an animal or anything worse than human. So they take refuge to prevent that. Others see that whether they come back in any form whatsoever, it's going to be problematic. Even coming back as a human being or as one of the long life gods and so forth, we're still subject to suffering. You see that, you have another aspiration to bring about your own liberation. Beyond that is the motivation to become fully awakened. This arises when you see that all beings are just the same as you. Now, when we undertake the practice of meditation, posture is very important. The most important aspect of posture, of course, is to have your spine straight. The reason for this is to do with the internal energies that are inside the body. If your back is held up straight in your spine, it makes everything flow easily. Whereas if you're sort of slumped over, then problems will arise. Mostly lethargy, sleepiness, drowsiness, and you don't hold things very well in your mind. So the spine should be straight but not stiff. Having a straight spine really is the foundation for mental alertness. It naturally lifts your energy and, like I said, it prevents sleepiness. Today, we're going to look at how to engage the mind in practice. Like last week was the body, today, mind. And in particular, we're going to be looking at placement and analytical meditations and how you can do them separately, but you actually want to combine them to get the best result. To help you prepare the class, I've relied upon these particular books here. So in this topic of concentration, and especially displacement meditations, there are two books here that are quite, you would say, they're sort of like PhDs, I guess. And this is Walking Through Walls and Study and Practice of Meditation. I think it's called A Tibetan Interpretations of the Concentrations and Formless Absorptions. What a mouthful. And it is hard going. It's dense, but it's like a treasure trove too. It's a really, after a while, of course, coming here, you have more and more questions. These two books are tremendous for answering them. And Walking Through Walls, there's whole sections there where students are sitting and just raising questions, and Geshe-Logdo answers them. And I'm pretty sure, I think she's engaged in both these books. Of course, something much simpler would be following in the Buddha's footsteps and steps on the path to enlightenment down here. Let's have a look at these things called concentration or placement. Concentration has various meanings depend upon the context. And when we talk about Buddhist concentration, I'll stop there for a minute. So all of us can concentrate, can't What do we normally concentrate on? What we're doing?
What we're not doing. Driving.
Driving, yeah, you've got to concentrate to drive. You've got to concentrate to do a lot of things, right? So the concentration is outer directed. Buddhist meditation is inner directed. That's the major difference. So when you hear this term concentration in Buddhism, it's not about how we can focus on driving or what we're doing or what we're not doing. It's
Yeah.
none of those things. It's taking often mental images and you're gazing inwardly at them. So not external images. So that's one thing. I guess that leads me into this idea of the context. So I'll just put up some of these things. So concentration itself is one of what they call one of five object ascertaining mental factors. So that's one way you can talk about concentration. So in other words, to place your mind on any object, it requires concentration, whether it be internal or external. And in the text, they can talk about that mental factor called concentration. There's another way they talk about concentration. This is what they call the concentration that leads to states of jhana. So these are really highly concentrated mental states that most people would probably not know existed, and most people would never even have a go at doing it. So these states are the form realm, the different types, and the formless realm. So they're absorptive states that are very deep and, let's see. I'll just leave it there, I think. so they're like a deep meditative absorptions, and they're not really to do with this realm. We call this world the desire realm. Right? But Buddhist philosophy presents three realms: desire realm, form realm, and a formless realm. And you can, as a human being, we can access each one of them. But if you can access these states of jhana, you're sort of you're a human being, but you have quite a different mind. Because most human beings don't have a type of mind that can do this. But we can develop it. And so this is one of the states. And it's a concentrated state. What else is there? Then we talk about concentration in terms of the three higher trainings. So in the three higher trainings, we have a higher training in ethics, a higher training in concentration, and a higher training in wisdom. They're called higher trainings because they're all based on refuge. In other words, we have concentration right now, but it's not higher concentration. Higher concentration is it's based on the refuge, on the idea, I'm getting out. But, well, I'm going to make sure I take another a higher round rebirth of my death, or I can use this here to go liberation, thank you, or enlightenment. We'll talk about concentration from that aspect. And then it says that concentration in other contexts, concentration refers to special meditations that enable a practitioner to engage in a specific activity. So there's a lot of words that don't seem to be saying much, very vague. But here, what they're really talking about here is when you do concentrations with a subtle mind. And so in that type of meditation, you might be seeing yourself as a deity, like we did in our meditation. You have a body, and in that body is energy. And so you place your attention on these different energy centers and create transformation within yourself. So in all these ways, we have this concentration and fit into all these different ways. But basically, all of it is saying that concentration is a way of training the mind from being sort of scattered and going wherever it wants to make it really powerfully focused. And here it's on one thing. So let me ask my question next. What's the purpose of doing this? We can see it in these other ones. Here's four different types of purpose. But in general, it's just to strengthen the mind's ability to focus on a single object or a topic. Now, when you try and do this, of course, it's not an easy thing to do. So, for instance, if we were to start to just meditate on the breath, I'm sure it wouldn't take us very long to be distracted. We might be able to focus on the breath for a little while, and we're probably pretty good at that. Probably be able to do it maybe for a minute. If you can do 2 minutes, that's really good. But then you'll find it goes somewhere else. It might go to... Geez, I wish that dog had stopped barking. Who was this? We had a lawnmower the other day, and someone's going, "Oh, that lawnmower." And I was going, "What lawnmower?" because I never heard it. Right? But for other people, they really got quite distracted. I never heard it because I was concentrated doing this teaching. So yes, this is the idea, is to basically stop the mind just wandering off as it does and just going to wherever it wants to go. Here it's also, so, you know, the goal is not to stop thoughts, but to repeatedly return your focus to one point. Like I said, the one point here was, I want you to bring your attention just down to your abdomen. And just like I went up like that, I can feel it come out. That's what I want you to notice. Yeah, so you feel it go out, you feel it drop back in. That's it. Sounds really simple. You could do it for one or two or three breaths, and then pretty quickly find you're thinking about dinner or the lawnmower or my back is sore, all sorts of things come in, and you go, okay, you need to fight that. You just need to recognize, oh, I've wandered off. I just come back home and start again. It's just sort of like gently persevering. You just keep doing this one thing. You're on it, you're off it. You've got to get back on it, you're off it. Get back on it, you're off it. And it's just on and on. And gradually over time, you stay on it more, longer and longer. And not only longer, but you become more aware of that object. In fact, in one of the books years ago, I read this guy said, yeah, meditation is like, it's like toilet training puppies or cats, you know? Like they poo anyway, but you got to pick them up and you got to put them in the place where they do it. And after a while, that's where they go. They do their business there. It's the same as us. Right? We're like little puppies too. We've got to find our sandbox. And that's where we do our business. Yeah. So placement meditation is, and this is what Asanga says, he says it is the one-pointed state of mind that stays fixed on its object of meditation without distraction to other things. Now, whether it is orientated toward serenity is another word for calm abiding, or towards insight, or toward both as a path that conjoins them, understand that this one-pointed state of mind is the bodhisattva's meditative stabilization. So here's the scenario. You can use this one-pointed state of mind to do like three different things here. You can use it for serenity, you can use it for insight, and you can pull them both together. You use it for both, not while they're conjoined. Now, the objects of meditation are numerous, many, and they keep changing over time. We're trying to change the mind. So there are a lot of things that don't work very well for us, so we have to sort of abandon them and place the mind on its opposite and become familiar with this opposite thing. Now, Lama Tsongkhapa says in his text, the great treatise on the path, that the object for beginners should be the figure of the Buddha. And this is particularly in the Gurupa tradition. Your object of meditation should be a mental image of the Buddha that is alive. So it's not like us looking at the statues here and going, okay, right, that's it. Okay, now I've got to imagine it there. Now we see like something's like a statue. No. You get the general drift, right? You look up and you go, how's the Buddha sitting? What's his skin? Golden. He's got the robes here. Okay. Now I've got to see a living being dressed in those robes, hand holding the begging bowl and so forth. Right? As vividly as you possibly can. Very much like, has anybody had a dream about seeing the Buddha or His Holiness or anything like that, or a holy being? But were they like statues in your dream? No, they're not real living beings, right? You get a bit of a shock to see them, isn't it? It's like, wow. it's special now, this dream. That's what meditation is a bit like. That's how you want to see them, like living beings like us. But at the same time, these statues, I guess they look a bit radiant, don't they, with the gold? That's how you try and see them. So the skin is radiant golden light. In fact, it's all light. However, at the same time, the object should be a little heavy to you because it's like a real person sitting up there on the throne. The idea of having it a little heavy is because you want to keep your mind stable on it. Otherwise, your own mind becomes light too, and off it goes. So you don't want that. And when we look at these, the statue of the Buddha or His Holiness the Dalai Lama as a living person, if you look at His Holiness as a person, what really has the biggest impact on us is his qualities. That's the thing, isn't it? You go, man, what a kind guy he is. Or how intelligent he is. How compassionate and open he is. All these things, they impress us. That's what's going to happen when we look at the statue. We're going to sort of go, oh, this, I am seeing the statue, of course, but in my mind, what I should be thinking of is the qualities of the Buddha. When we see the Dalai Lama, we think of his qualities. And we probably do, don't we? We see him and go, like how compassionate he is, how kind he is. This is the same thing. So you have this image there, and if you think about it, it's like you're looking into whatever you can create or generate of that figure being alive and having all those great qualities. That's what's going to come back at you. So the better you can do it, the greater the impact will be on you. This is the same idea. You know, like when you have you think about things and you get scared. What's scaring you?
Your own mind.
That's right. It's the same here. What's really making you feel fantastic? Your own mind. So instead of looking at someone that's really scary, you look at someone that's really gorgeous and got these great qualities and they're ready to go, oh, wow. So the better you can make it come alive and exude these great warm qualities, the better the effect is going to be on you. And remember, this is the amazing thing about this, I think, is like how skillful it is. It's like, you know, you chuck it out, that's what you get. Whatever you can put out there, it comes back at you.
It's like an implicit kind of a teaching on projection.
Yeah, for sure. Because, you know, we project our fears and who gets scared?
Yeah.
Well, we do. So we want to project all the good qualities that we feel. Our mind becomes immersed in them. Yeah, it seems like it's all coming from over there, but in fact, it's only over there because you're over here and you did it all.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's the idea behind this thing. Oh my God, I should slap myself and tell myself I should have seen this years ago. I'm so sorry, Sam. Yeah, so you'll see this again and again with the there are these practices where you sort of dissolve the wrong conception of who you are and how you exist as a normal person, right? And so now you reappear as a deity. So trying to feel it and thinking it, you get all that. And then you switch it around again and you come out and you come back. So it's always about dependent arising and emptiness. So some of you might have heard this. His Holiness has said that the cause of suffering is an undisciplined mind and the cause of happiness is a disciplined mind. So when we're doing this, this requires a disciplined mind, doesn't it? You know, we can't just let them think, oh, the mind will do it for me and sit there. Sometimes it can start off right, but now you have to sort of build on it. And then you want to hold it, right? As long as you possibly can. Because the longer you hold it, the greater the benefits are for you. I mean, you create it, you experience it. And this is just like karma. It's an action. You create the action, you get the effect. Here's another action we're creating and we're getting the effect directly. Okay, so let's do a very brief, it's not time for me, I want to do one now. So you can see behind me these lights, the lotus lights that are on the altar there. Okay, so What's that light look like to you? Is it nice, warm appearing light? Okay. So I want you to imagine that at your heart is a light that's just like that. Yeah? So that's what we have to do. So just try that now. And we'll just do it for like, so 1 minute. Yeah? And just see what happens. Try to hold that light there and get a feeling for it, for its warmth, its radiance. So of course you know you don't need to meditate with your eyes closed. You quickly look at it like, oh, there's the warmth, there's the light. Yep, it's right there in my heart. Okay, now just let that idea go. Open your eyes if you like. And click. So how did you go? You able to see something like that and imagine it there? And any sort of feeling or emotional response to having like a light like that inside your chest? Yeah, you want to make, it should make you feel like good, like glowing. There's I don't know how I mean, one time many years ago, that I thought, gee, a lot of this these meditation techniques are about taking things that appear to us in the world and just slightly moving them over. Yeah. So I remember this one other time, you know, when they talk about the blessings. You know, so I said, okay, we're all sitting here. Now, all the enlightened beings above us, and because we've had this great wish to do these things, they're so pleased, the lights and nectar stream down. So, you know, you try and best thing you can is imagine, to try to imagine it. But do you get a feeling for it? Because if you don't, next time, next morning or tonight when you have a shower, consciously feel that water come down on you and imagine that that's the light and nectar. Right? So you get the feeling. Then the next time you do it, you're not in the shower, and you're sitting there and thinking, okay, now down comes all the lights and nectars from the Buddhas, you remember the feeling of what it's like to have a shower. And so you get a feeling, but it's associated now with light and nectar and not ordinary water. So just as ordinary water, you know, we use it to clean our body, this is like to clean our insides out. So you want to try and bring as much feeling into these things as possible. Yeah, so like I said, so concentration is we're using the mind in this way, really imaginatively, most of the time, but there's also a huge stuff to do with reasoning. We're not imagining, we're just thinking in a particular way, which we'll come to also. Now, when we undertake these types of meditation, we need assistance. So far I've been talking mainly about sutra yana methods. So Buddhism, you can divide it up into two ways. You go, there's the sutras and there's the tantras. And in the sutras, we're primarily talking about that here, single pointed concentration is cultivated with this ordinary consciousness that we have. And this ordinary consciousness that we have and we use all the time is related to our body. We have a body and a mind, right? This coarse thing here and this coarse mental thing. Now, because it's coarse, it's now, and it's related to the body, therefore, external factors like the altitude, like the temperature, like the time of day, like your physical health, can all influence your ability to meditate. For instance, if you've had a big meal and then you go to try and meditate, it's not a good idea. Trying to meditate like with a lot of noise, with a lawnmower's going, it's really difficult. So we do need, like I said, conducive conditions to meditate. So here are six of them. We do need a favorable place. So that's why I say if you're doing this at home, get a place that's a good place that you like to go to and do the very best you can to make it your favorite place. Then you'll go there. should be sort of calm, quiet, sort of secluded. We do this now before we actually go and do a retreat. If you want to do a long retreat, you need all these things. But meanwhile, we try and cultivate them at home. So prior to entering a strict retreat, you have to develop sort clear and a correct understanding of the instructions. You know, it's like, what are you going to meditate on? How do you meditate on something like this? You need to be clear in your own mind. This is what I do. These are the steps. And in fact, you want to be doing it quite a bit before you actually do this, like in a retreat, right? The retreat's just a time where you're going to become much more familiar with your meditation practice. So you should have a meditation practice already, and you know how to meditate. Third is like having a few desires. So you'd be very surprised, like so Corrie's story is often when he sits to meditate, he always has the desire to go to the fridge. They go, yeah, that's right. So that's what happens. So you're going to say, okay, try and make yourself as content as possible and have as few desires as possible. Which needs to be so content. So you don't want to be like too busy or have too much to do. And lastly, what they call having few worldly activities. In fact, the less activity you have to do with the world, the easier it's going to be for you to meditate longer, more clearly, and so forth. So I say to say, you're all here, so I can see some of you are quite tired. And I remember when I was working and coming home, go, oh, I can't get tired. Oh my God, it really gave me a lot of respect for everybody who comes out here every night. Because I was dead tired. I was going to like, how do people do this? Like go to work and then come here after work and listen to me talk. Like, I just want to lie down. Yeah, so the fewer worldly activities you have, the easier it's going to be to have a successful meditation practice. So these are the five, one more, I think, maybe. Yeah, pure ethical conduct. So you do want to be ethical. It's like you don't get involved in criminal stuff or crazy stuff. You don't want to be worried, right? You do not want to go into a meditation thing worried and anxious and thinking about what might happen, what's hanging over you. Don't have those things hanging over you. Be clear and okay, right? You're ready to go. Nothing holding you back. Nothing you need to be worried about. So suppose you have all these, right? And now you're off to meditate, then a new lot of problems come. The fact I was reading, I was just telling Ben about a presentation I just read about emptiness, and the guy was saying, we've got two major obstacles to our happiness, outer obstacles and inner obstacles. So here, by having these things here, we're getting rid of some of the outer obstacles. But then we have the inner obstacles. So sensual desire is a big thing. So this is, like I said, so Kari's one was food. What did I do? Oh. So one time we were at the center and we did a numne. And so you have these sort of sessions. So numne is a matter of like if one day you don't eat or drink water after a certain hour and you wait for the next morning. And then after the first session you can. It's about 20 hours or something like that. Anyway, I remember him becoming furious, really angry about this. And I just walked out the center. I'm out of here. I'm going down to the garage to get me a soft drink. And I did. Garage is just on the corner. I mean, straight down, soft drink, chips. And as soon as I had them, all like I had it, I hadn't even eaten them. But all my desire just vanished. It's like, geez, that was weird. Like, you know, like I remember it's like I just sort of like stopped down there. I was so angry. Yeah, you know, I just went back to the center and just sat down and kept going. But you know, like, I never forget it, of course, because it's like I really didn't care what anybody thought about me. I'm just, you know, I was like, I'm going. So sensual desires is a big thing that you'll get. And the other thing that I got, of course, was malice. So this is this anger comes up, right? And I'm sort of thinking, like, why do I have to, what's the point? Why do I do this? No. That's what happens. Now, as the session unfolds, what's going to happen is you're going to get tired. And so, like, you might decide, oh, I'm going to meditate for, 24 minutes, not too long, 24 minutes at a time. Yeah, okay, that's good. So you do the first one, yeah, no problem, it's great. Second one, yeah, that's good too. Come the third one, you might be thinking, geez, I've got another five to go. So you do the third one. And then it's like in the gap, then you want the gap to be longer. And then after a little while, it's like you can sort of, you know, everyone sat there with him, he goes like that. Like, so that sort of thing happens. So, and then, like I said, for me, of course, restlessness. Like, I don't want to be here. I don't want to be doing this retreat. Oh, I'm sick of it. In fact, I regret even doing these luminaries. I'm out of here. So I found, like, how I got so assailed by my own thoughts, but was thinking it was because of the luminary. That was doing it. Yeah, just how deluded you can become, right? It's nobody doing it to you. It's your own mind. The mind drove me crazy. Yeah. And so that's right. Right. Well, I've gone half way. I go, it's not only you, it's me. Uh-huh. so I think, you know, you are a condition for it. But that's all.
That's,
you know,
well,
like,
yeah.
But primary, sense. It's my mind. You know, yeah. I am being triggered by the other object.
Yeah.
But many other times you don't need another object. Your mind will do it to yourself.
That's clever.
And then, of course, then you get all these doubts about why am I doing this? This is pointless. How can doing all these prostrations be good for me? How can starving myself for 20 hours and not drinking water? What sort of transformation is going to take place? You know, so all these questions start arising. And in fact, probably we would have better if we tackled that before I even did the retreat. You know, but many times you don't quite know what you're doing when you do these things.
Number two, clear understanding.
That's right. Yeah. That's why I didn't have that, you see. And that's what often happens when you do these things. Now you come in, oh, we're doing this. Oh, what's that? Someone can't explain it to you, but you sit there and give it a go. Yeah, but you're not really clear. So this leads us to what's interesting about this for you. So really look here as concentration is sort of progressive training of the mind, right? And we've looked at to progressively train the mind, you're going to run up against obstacles. They're mainly internal, but they're also external. Like, for instance, if your place was not a favorable place to meditate in, if there are dogs barking all the time. In fact, one of our students here gave up his whole practice. Like, he was trying to become a Buddhist. He bought all these books, he was reading and studying, and this dog, his neighbor's dog, always barked. And he was really working himself up. And in the end, he came back and he gave all the books back and said, I'm going to take up Christianity. No, he did. It was the same. And he was a really, really nice guy. But, like, it just bothered him so much. He just sort of, like, yeah, I was, how's that going to work? God, someone's going to do something to that dog, I guess. Or something to you, it's not going to bother you. Yeah, so, you know, an unfavorable place is not good for meditating. To have wrong understanding or incomplete understanding, that doesn't help. Having a lot of desires won't help you. To be discontent all the time, that's not going to work for you. You know, having a lot to do, that's not going to help. You know, to have stuff hanging over yourself, like recent, could something bad could happen? That's not going to help. So there's a lot of them. And then, of course, you have these things as well. So there's a lot that can get in the way of training the mind. So the more assistance you can get, and I'd say that mainly the assistance is mainly through study or finding people who have done long retreats. Even somebody's done like 3 months. Remember the student that sometimes comes here? You do the 3 month retreat. He said, I nearly drove myself crazy. How comes? Oh, well, I did it on my own. Yeah, well, you know about that, don't you? But still, you thought you could do it. So oftentimes when you meditate, especially the first, like if you do a retreat, meaning you're going to spend a few days or a month or longer, don't do it by yourself. Do it in company. Yeah? Why? So you can share your experience. And because the energy of two is more than one. And the other person, especially if they're more experienced than you, can help you. Yeah? So company is often recommended. And Lama Yeshe says, yeah, I know what your wisdom is like. I suggest you do a group retreat. You'll do it by yourself. Because that's what we're like. Right? Yeah, that's right. We know better. You know, we think it's easy, and it's not. So we're trying to train the mind progressively, slowly, gently, reasonably, but we do need supportive conditions to work against the different types of hindrances. So if you like, let's do our first meditation. Yeah, that's it. Just get comfortable in your seat. Maybe just raise your shoulders up to your ears and then just drop them. That's it. Give your shoulders a good shake. And sort of have your spine nice and straight, your shoulders relaxed, but be gentle about this. Then let your body breathe itself. And just gently settle into the rhythm of your breath. So our intention for doing this meditation is to altruistically transform our scattered attention into a powerful tool which produces inner peace. So concentration is not a single effort, it's a progressive path of training. And this path requires creating supportive conditions in our life while mindfully working with inner obstacles. But this type of holistic approach turns ordinary focus into a sort of unshakable stability, which is needed for liberating wisdom. So as you know, it's near impossible to grow a healthy plant in a dark room with bad soil. Well, think about your mind as being the plant and the conditions around you, which are required to create like a perfect greenhouse so the plant grows healthily and well. So I wonder how daily life can act as the soil for our practice. So acting ethically each day and being content creates the rich soil within the greenhouse. It allows the plant of the mind to flourish. But when we come to meditate, hindrances arise. So when you've been meditating, which hindrances do you notice most of all? So, states like worry, anxiety, or desire and attachment are probably more noticeable than other things. But if you can sort of see them as like, try to see them as like temporary clouds. It's just sort of, they come into the greenhouse and they just move out. The plants remain. The concentration is about this stable mind, and this stable mind is crucial for seeing reality clearly. The stable mind is the basis for developing the wisdom. So the stable mind provides an undisturbed, clear atmosphere within the greenhouse that allows the plant of wisdom to receive light and to grow strong. Now just for a few moments, choose an object of focus. Perhaps it's just the breath. Now just relax and feel the breath in the body as you breathe normally and naturally. And now just gently exhale and let your eyes flutter open. Something I think is useful to remember that the rewards of meditation are really nourished by the life you live when you're not meditating. You want to try and lead a real, an ethical, good life. That's you need that as a basis to meditate well.
Not having a guilt conscience.
Yeah, that's right. You don't want guilt, regrets, all these sort of things. Like try and deal with them now. You don't want that stuff coming up and later on. You know, just do it early in the piece. In fact, I remember many, many years ago now, when I was sort of reading and studying, I got on the phone and rang back to New Zealand and rang up people that I'd hurt and said sorry and apologized to the thing, because I thought, man, like, suppose I die in meditation or die here. Like, I don't want that. I've not always been a nice person, but so I've done silly things. And they've hurt people. Like, that's going to come up for me. Like, and I don't want it to bring about, you know, bad effects. So I'm going to say my sorries now and put it down, and then we'll get more engaged in this. So now we're going to talk about analytical meditation. So it's, what do I say to this? The use of a focused inquiry to understand reality.
It's so cool, right?
It's nice, eh?
It's so cool.
Focused inquiry to understand reality. So we can have a lot of intellectual knowledge about Buddhist ideas like impermanence and selflessness, but the knowledge often fails to change how we feel or act. We still get upset when things change, and we still cling to things as if they're going to last forever. So you'll find this again and again as you study. It's like, gee, I'm still doing the same things I used to do before, even though I have all this knowledge, but I really haven't changed much at all. So I heard speaking to someone the other day, and I was sort of saying they're quite disappointed in many of the things that Buddhists do. I thought, yeah. I thought, yeah, of course, because Buddhists are just people. And there are many Buddhists who have a lot of knowledge, but then you watch how they behave. It's like, it's a bit shocking. And so that's quite right. But like I said, I try to point out, remember, they're just people. They're samsaric people. They've taken up this path, but they've still got lots of problems. So what is the reality we're to try to understand here or to inquire into? Well, there's a number of these objects of inquiry, one of them being the self, like us, like who are we? How do we exist? So that's one. The other is the mind. What is this phenomenon called mind? Like, what is it? And how does it behave? How does it create like happiness or sorrow? They're the major objects for a Buddhist. Of course, there are other objects we can inquire into, like what's a statue made out of, or anything external, but these are not objects that the Buddhists focus and inquire into. The major thing is like how does this thing called a person exist? Yeah, so we try to understand that. So what are the benefits of this? All right. Deep transformative understanding. So have you ever had the effect where there was something that you thought was true, and then within a moment or two, you knew it wasn't? Anything like that ever happened to you? Like it's quite sometimes it can be very shocking, but quite enjoyable too. It's so strange, isn't it? One time I had this experience where I was sure that what had just taken place was a bad thing. I remember it so vividly because when it happened, I was in the kitchen and the sitting room, and I walked between, I was in the sitting room upset because this thing had happened. And I walked through the doorway, and by the time I got to the kitchen, I was laughing and happy. Oh, it's like, wow. I thought this way, and then I realized that no, in fact, it was this. So there's this utter transformation. That time I thought I was a real idiot. And I walked through the door, I thought, no, I'm not. It's like, actually, it's a real great thing that happened to me. I just learned what doesn't work. On one side of the door, I was so upset because I'd done it all wrong and blah, blah, blah. And then on the other side, I was like, no, this is a great discovery. I just know now this does not work. I guess it might be a bit like Tommy Dot, though. That guy who took 10,000 experiments to invent the electric light? I don't know, but he said, they asked him, weren't you disappointed? He said, heck no. Every time I discovered something that didn't work, I thought, well, gee, that's a great attitude to have, isn't it? We would look
That's
upon
why
it
he
as a
went for
failure
it.
and get frustrated. He's going, no, I know, we can wipe that one out, that don't work. I'm just working out what doesn't work. Well, that's transformative, isn't it? That's great. This analytical meditation is primarily through reasoning, through thinking. A little while ago, I was thinking about how it is that you could like all sentient beings. And I was just sort of thinking like how really difficult this was. And then it was like, then I realized you're like, that's because you're looking at sentient beings in a way that is not conducive to seeing their kindness. So what is the way? And it's really simple. It's like right there in the text. See all sentient beings as your own mother. That's where the Buddha start off from. It's like, you're not all strangers, we're all related. You'll be my mother countless times, blah, blah, blah. And I really appreciate the kindness you extended towards me and given birth to me. And when you weren't my mother, how you didn't hurt me and how you helped me and all these different things. So then that's where they start. They look at this thing of looking at through countless lifetimes of rebirth and that, and say, okay. If this is the thinking model that we've lived life after life after life, then we've been born again and again and again, that means we had to have a mother. So can you look at anybody and decide that person is not my mother in the countless lives had? Not with any certainty, no. So they have a different starting place. And I thought, wow, okay, if I want to develop this idea and really like everybody, that's probably the place to start. Right, so to do that, then so you've got to do this analysis of countless past lives. You've been born again. To be born, you need a mother. You'll die, then you'll be born again. You will need a mother. So you start from there, and then look at the kindness, and then it'll naturally come about where you feel warm-hearted towards everybody. But if you don't, then it gets a little So this sort of thing, the other, of course, is meditation on impermanence. So you don't just sit there and think impermanence, 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 I'm going to just watch everything fade away. And no, that ain't going to do it. You got to have good reasons. So that's what you do, right? And you try and refute, but the idea is, no, all that stuff has been done. This is how I think now. This is the thinking to do. Same as when you look for the self, that is, whether you are the body or the mind or something in between or something outside or different, whatever. It's the same sort of thing. You just do an analysis. You go, okay, if I existed the way that I appear to myself, there's only a couple of ways that could be. I'm either different or I'm the same. I'm either different from the body or I'm the same as the body. There's no wriggle room here. Right? Well, if I were different than the body, what would happen? Yeah? So you know what would happen. Right? If I were different than the body, something that happened to my body, it wouldn't affect me. But it does, doesn't it? So I can't be different from the body. But if I'm the same, what's the problem there? You say, well, this body is made up of all these parts. If I'm the same as the body, then there's got to be heaps of me. There's a whole lot of me. But there's not. There's just one me. So you do this type of thinking until it becomes quite clear that you cannot be the same as the body, and neither can you be something completely different. I said, what's the option? It's not that you don't exist. That's not correct. You're sitting there thinking about this. So what's left? Oh my God. I know. Who am I? What? That's right.
Exactly.
I know, exactly.
Almost like there's a bit of way.
Yeah. So you get this sort of thing where it's like this, you have to sort of stop thinking, yeah, it's like, well, I'm not that and I'm not this, like, but can you just rest in that? Can you just rest in that knowledge? You come on, okay, I still don't know who I am. I know what I'm not, but I don't know quite who I am yet. So one of the things I'll say, so there, it's very useful to come back to the definition of what a person is. The definition of a person is an I or self that's imputed to the body or mind, or the combination of body and mind from the five aggregates. So you find, oh, then I'm just, I is just a name or a label attached dependently to the body or mind, given to the body or mind. That's it. Since I'm not the body and I'm not something, I'm not the body, I'm not something separate from it, yet here I am. How can that be? Well, it's really simple. I'm just called, I am called my body. I am someone's called my mind. My mind is something sometimes called me. That's it. That's how I actually exist, as a name given to these other things, put on it, labeled on it. So I was talking to Ben before about this exercise you can do when you have something that looks so real, like in this case, I saw a very big picture of a flower, you know, the petals and everything. You look at it, you go, what do you see? So a flower. Does that flower, the picture of the flower exist? Yes, it does. Go up a little closer. Flower story? Yes, it is. Go up even closer. Is it there now? And you look at it and go, no. What's there? It says, well, there's all these little pixels. Yeah. Just like we go up to the TV, you know, the screens, and you sit back there, it looks like there's people, all sorts of things. Right? You go up a little closer. You're closer, so the screen goes a bit funny, there's no actual people there. It's just all these little colored pixels changing all the time. It's just like us. There you are, go up closer. Go right up close. Are you there now? Is the body right there now? You have to get out, you're gonna end up saying no. No, it's not. Are you seeing the body? No.
Those pixels are just light.
Yeah, that's right. Then, so Dad, what are we?
Mind.
We are a body and a mind. The name is put on. It's called me. Or I. It's just like that, you know. You've got the pixels that make up the picture. Here we have a body and a mind that make up a person. You go up closer, one of them's going to vanish. Doesn't mean to say you don't exist. It's just not there. I am not there. Step back here, oh, there I am. So that analysis, that's the insight. We're looking inside. Now the thing, of course, is to put these two together. So the way you do that is just not what we're saying, right? So we go to this thing, so are you the body? If I am, what's the problem? What happens if I say I am? You say, well, then you must, what are the consequences? You physically exist. Okay, well, this body physically exists, yes, which part of it is you? Then again, like this again, you know, you're going up to find the part that's me. No, it's none of them. So when you don't find yourself there, you place your attention fully on that not finding. I am not there. That's right, you're not there. So you stay on that, you stabilize, that's your placement. You place the mind on that knowledge. The idea about it is to make this transformative process so that you don't grab at your body to be you. Because you're not you. That's not you. Right? Other people's bodies, it's not them either. So, you know, so the idea is to become familiar with this. See, you know, like the analysis is correct, you stabilize the wisdom that knows it. Yeah, so this is this thing, you know, like, so for instance, for most of us, like, we all know we're going to die, don't we? I hope we do. I'm sure we all do, we don't like to admit it, but we are all going to die. So we know this. We know everybody else is going to die too. Yeah? Yeah, we get really upset when they do, don't we? But why? So I said, I can get that. So I'm saying this is because the wisdom has not been stabilized. Because, yeah, of course I know they're going to die. Of course I know I'm going to die. Should that be upsetting? And again, he said, well, who dies? Who is the person that dies? Remember that little analysis we did before? Like, where is this person that's going to die? Like, I looked in here, he's not there. Right? So there's a whole lot of Buddhist threads that come together. You find out one thing, especially wisdom realizing selflessness, because it leads you into dependent arising. And that shows you the conventional world. That this the world exists through convention, not ultimately. I exist conventionally, not truly, not really, not ultimately. So therefore I can't really die, truly die, ultimately die. Why? Because I wasn't ultimately born. You will never find yourself if you do this analysis, right? So how can that person die? So a lot of fear just falls away. This wisdom overcomes fear. That's its main job. Overcome fear. You find that all the things you're afraid of, basically, they're not findable when you search for them. The person is looking for them, they're not findable either. Yeah. So you can sort of like relax into that, rest in that knowledge. So when it comes to actually die, hey, you're going to be cool about it. Yeah, as you know, that thing that you think is me that's going to die, it can't. It never actually existed in the first place. It's just a name. That's how it existed, as a name. Nothing more than that. I is a name given to the body sometimes, sometimes it's given to the mind, sometimes it's given to both of them together. It's not either one of them simply, it's not something different than it. It's just a name. So you know, you see that the name will go out of this world. You go, that's right, just like it came in. Somebody gave it, now it's gone. Conditions don't hold. So yeah, so the idea of this bringing them together is to make them strong, so that we hold on to it and act in accordance with it. As like I'm saying, if you really knew about how phenomena lack true existence, then you think these phenomena die conventionally, but not ultimately, not truly. That's it. See, you want to know that, right? Because that's the fact. It's not made up or anything. It's just the truth. It's a conventional truth. So, before I began becoming a Buddhist, all I was really interested in was the truth. I wanted to find out what was true. You mean, ultimately true. That would always be true. And I couldn't find a thing. Not a thing. And that's because there isn't anything that's ultimately true. There isn't anything that exists ultimately. All convention, names, parts, holes, all that sort of stuff. So here, so like I said, this holiness meditates on emptiness like six times a day. Recently, some of us undertook a practice called Succession Guru Yoga. That's what you do. You familiarize yourself with the truth six times a day. You familiarize yourself with the mind of enlightenment, going, okay, I'm doing this to become enlightened, to benefit others. I need to do that six times a day. So this is what we do. We analyze, and the analysis is to produce an insight or feeling. So before I said about the blessings of all the Buddhas coming down, you want to associate with a feeling of bliss, right? Like, wow, this feels great. Okay, I've been talking a bit. So, when you apply, you produce an insight or a feeling through your analysis, and then you rest your mind within that state. As Holiness the Dalai Lama says, having drawn forth an experience that transforms the mind, one must place the mind intently within that experience without discursive analysis. So you do the discursive analysis beforehand, then you place your concentration, your placement, just on that. Just rest in it. So I say that become familiar with this reality. Okay. Thank you. Is that right? Excuse me.
first talk took kind of way.
Okay, we're going to miss this meditation. That's all right. So when we meditate, one of the meditations you want to do is on the nature of the mind. It's like I say, when we're looking at how phenomena exist, this examination of reality, it's this phenomena called mind that, when it's undisciplined, creates suffering. When it's disciplined, it doesn't. And so we need to know about this mind, how it exists conventionally and ultimately. Okay, we'll do this meditation. Last one. Again, just get comfortable in your seat. So I want you to remember any birthday that happened in the past. Okay, now I want you to imagine the statue of the Buddha behind me. So if you're not sure, to just look at it and come down and just reimagine it. Okay. So was there a difference in what appeared before your first recollection of the birthday and the second recollection of the Buddha statue? Is there a difference in those two recollections? Well, the answer should be yes, because one is of a birthday and one is of a Buddha, and they're different.
Okay,
yep, that's right. So that's what I'm sort of getting at, right? If you think of the birthday, okay, yep, okay, it's my birthday. Okay, now I think of the Buddha. Okay, that's the Buddha. There's a difference there, isn't it? They're completely two different objects, right? So you say, was there a difference in your recollection? You go, yeah, they're two different objects. So knowledge of the difference is the knowing aspect of mind. What appears as birthday and statue, this is the clarity aspect. And this topic, this is going there. So this is just a way of being, some sort of experience of, this is what we mean by the mind being clear and knowing. The clarity gives you the appearance of both these objects. One is the statue, one is the birthday. There's a difference between them, isn't there? That's called knowing. You know the difference. You know they're not the same. You know they're different. That's the knowing nature of the mind. That's all it is. Appearances, that's the clarity. You know those appearances. That's the knowing. That's mind. Okay, that should do for tonight. So, your takeaway, the idea is, like I said, the placement gives you stability. That's what we sort of start with. Up to a point. You got to start with it, then you do analysis, then you come back to stability. You know, you want to have the mind stable so you can analyze, so you can think clearly. Once you've come to the correct conclusion, stop analysis, rest the mind on it. It works like that simple. Analysis develops the wisdom and the insight. So analysis to understand, placement to absorb the understanding. I'm just thinking about how we do this to people we don't like. Right? You know, you analyze the person's behavior, you think it's wrong, you rest the mind on it. You go, that's a bad guy.
On the judgment, right?
Yeah, that's right. We come to this judgment. That guy's off. Yeah, that's not a bad object. But, yeah, we can do it on the good objects too. It's as simple as that. So we have some notes up there. So you can see, if you go online, there's some LTC notes, page 25 to 26, 37 to 39. And we've also got some extras, LTC extras, 16 to 19. So next week, we're going to be looking at intentions and dedications. So let's do dedication. There's one of them. So join me in saying, due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the Supreme Lord, Bodhicitta, not yet born, arise and grow. May that born have no decline but increase forevermore. And as long as space remains, as long as sentient beings remain, may I too remain to dispel the sorrows of the world. The Dalai Lama's long life. The wish granting, wish fulfilling jewel, source of every single benefit and happiness of this world. To the incomparably kind, Tenzin Gyatso, I beseech. May all your holy wishes be spontaneously fulfilled. And lastly, for Rinpoche's quick recognition. In building and spreading the Muni's precious and complete teachings through explanation and practice, you wore the armor of patience that is never discouraged. Incomparable, venerable Guru, to you, and make this request.